Welcome to Discovery and Inspiration, a podcast from the National Humanities Center. I'm Jacqueline Kellish, Director of Public Engagement at the Center, and your host for this episode. The British writer, reformer, and criminologist George Cecil Ives lived through a transformation in our collective understanding of sexuality. Born in 1867, Ives found early inspiration in the classical tradition and witnessed the rise of sexology and psychoanalysis before his death in the mid-20th century. But Ives did not simply observe these social changes. He chronicled them exhaustively through his published works, correspondence, scrapbooks, and a 3-million-word diary. Analyzing these records can help us to understand how individuals actually experience these philosophical and social shifts. Our guest today is doing exactly that. Brian Lewis is professor of history and classical studies at McGill University, where his research focuses on the social and cultural history of 19th and 20th century Britain. This year, as a fellow at the center, Brian is working on a project tentatively titled Greek to the Soul, George Ives and Homosexuality from Wilde to Wolfenden. Welcome, Brian. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Brian, your current book project focuses on large, complex questions across fields of history, queer theory, and criminology. But you tackle these issues primarily through the lens of one man's writings, experiences, and activities. Can you start out by telling us a little bit about George Cecil Ives and why he emerged as such an ideal figure to help you understand this period of historical change?
Yes, of course. I first came across George Ives in Geoffrey Weeks's pioneering book on the history of homosexuality in Britain, which came out in the late 1970s. It's called Coming Out. And Weeks has just a brief description of Ives and the fact that he founded the first gay rights organization in Britain in the early 1890s. And the organization is called the Order of Carinia. And then Matt Cook, who has now become one of the leading historians of homosexuality in Britain, followed up with a more detailed discussion of George Ives in his book, London and the Culture of Homosexuality, which came out in 2003. So in reading Weeks and Cook, I was aware of George Ives. I was also aware that there was this massive diary and assorted other parts of the Ives archive, mostly at the University of Texas at Austin, to some extent at the Beinecke Library at Yale, and in various repositories in the United Kingdom. And it occurred to me that there was the possibility of writing a much broader history of the fundamental changes in understandings of human sexuality from the late 19th to the mid-20th century, a very key period in the field, through looking at Ives and what he produced. So he's going to be my way in to this much bigger story. So that's why I began to investigate him. It was about 15 years ago now. I've been far too slow at this project. I've been working on it for far too long, but I hope when the book comes out, it will be all the better because of it.
Ives really was a fascinating figure. And you mentioned that part of the appeal of the Ives archive is that it deals with a number of different sources, from the diaries to correspondence to scrapbooks of various clippings he collected. And I'm just curious to know how these diaries, the correspondence, and the other records bring together Ives' very personal reflections about his own life and experiences with larger theoretical and cultural debates of the time. How did he balance the public and the private in these very detailed records that he kept?
Well, let me tell you just a little bit about him. He grew up in a gentry family, so lesser landed aristocracy in the south of England, but he was illegitimate. His father was a landowner, but also a military man. And his mother apparently descended from the Spanish aristocracy, at least Ives claimed that, but that's not borne out by the actual census records. So it's, you know, open to some doubt and speculation there. But he was illegitimate, which meant that his mother was forced to abandon him at birth. And he was brought up by his paternal grandmother, partly in her country house in Hampshire, the south of England, partly in her townhouse in London, and partly in her Villa Ives in Nice on the French Riviera, with all of the other aristocratic set who went down to the Riviera every winter. This is where he grew up. He didn't go to school. He was educated by private tutors at home. Then he went to Magdalen College, Cambridge, at the age of 19. And it was when he was there that he began to write his diary, mostly because he had already discovered that he was different from other boys. He had discovered that he preferred boys to girls, and he wanted to understand why this was and why society rejected it. And he began to find justification in the classics. And most homosexual men of that generation, because they were steeped in the classics at public, i.e., in the British sense, private schools and at university, they found their justification in the examples from, in particular, ancient Greece, where sexual expression between men, all men, was more or less routine. Quite logically came to the conclusion that if it was routine and accepted then there is something wrong about our Victorian society now, which categorically rejects it. And that began his campaigning for the rights of what he called sexual inverts. The term homosexuality hadn't really caught on by that date. And he also began campaigning for the rights of criminals, because those sexual inverts who fell foul of the law and who were arrested were incarcerated. So the rights of prisoners in Britain's Victorian jails became very important to him as well. So you see the development of these two tracks at a very early age in his life, the campaign for the rights of sexual inverts and the campaign for the rights to improve prisons.
That makes a great deal of sense as to why both of those spheres would have come together in Ives' life and his public-facing work. When you mention the question of inverts and the question of community that Ives found himself among and also sought to create during his lifetime, I understand that he had some fairly famous acquaintances who were also privy to some of these same discussions and debates. Can you tell us a little bit more about the kinds of communities that Ives formed with other notable thinkers of the day?
That's right. Yes, he did. He was aware of the early sexologists, mainly coming out of Germany, to some extent France, but also increasingly from England as well. Thinkers like Edward Carpenter, who was a leading humanitarian socialist and campaigner for gay rights. Carpenter and Ives became friends in the early 1790s. He also met Oscar Wilde, who was part of the same circle, in about 1893. And so there is a lot of material about their meetings over the next couple of years, and then the trials, of infamous trials of Oscar Wilde, which ended up with Wilde being incarcerated for 2 years on homosexual offences, helping lead to his early death in 1900. So there is a lot of material about Wilde in the diaries. There is a lot of material about Edward Carpenter. And then Ives, as part of his campaigning for sexual inverts, not only founded this Order of Carinia around about 1893-1894, which was the first organization for gay rights in Britain, but it was very clandestine and very secretive. So he was also part of another organization, the Society for the Study of Sex Psychology, which was founded around about 1912-1913 in London, and was much more open and much more transparent. And was founded at a meeting when the leading lights in German sexology, Magnus Hirschfeld, came over to London and took part and helped found it. So there was lots of correspondence and lots of detail in the diary about Hirschfeld as well. Those are some of the leading figures that Ives was associated with. He's also reading a lot of sexological literature. He's reading Freud when Freud first comes to greater attention. He later on becomes very interested in Radcliffe Hall, who with her novel, The Well of Loneliness, which was prosecuted in the late 1920s because of his advocacy of same-sex love. He corresponds with her. There's quite a lot about her in the diaries as well. So again, we can see through the diaries, through the correspondence, through all of this material, a sense of this network of connections and individuals who are all campaigning and working in very different ways for the same cause.
So this network, it seems, was not only hugely important for Ives on a sort of personal level to find companionship and to relate to others who were experiencing and thinking about the same topics, but was a really central part of reform efforts of the day. And so this really helps us, I think, to understand why one figure, George Cecil Ives, becomes so important for giving us a window onto this historical moment. So what you're practicing with this project is something that we often refer to as microhistory, focusing on smaller, very specific sort of details, events, or individuals. I think rarely when people practice microhistory do they have access to such records as detailed and comprehensive as Ives. But I wonder, as a historian, can you talk a little bit more about how you understand microhistory relative to other modes of historical writing and expression, and why this has been something that you think is particularly suitable to this historical moment?
Yes, well, I think microhistory, it takes something very, very particular as a way of opening up a much broader world. The classic example is the pioneering book in microhistory by Carlo Ginzburg called The Cheese and the Worms, which takes the crazy notions of an Italian cheesemaker in medieval Italy and develops ideas about religion and the cosmos from that starting point. Ives is not quite so eccentric, though he is eccentric in many ways, but he does allow us, I think, to see this much bigger picture. And it's not only the fact that he is writing and he is campaigning, it's also his domestic life and his social observations, his daily round. He moved from the countryside into London, lived in London for most of his life, mostly in a suburban house in North London, where he lived with a succession of younger men who sometimes stayed for just a few years, sometimes they stayed for decades. All of these domestic relationships are an important part of queer history that is often missed, I think, in mainstream queer histories that look at the public face and the politics, forgetting that most of us live our lives at home and in the domestic space. Well, Ives gives us an insight into all of that. He also gives us an insight into many different social activities. There's a whole history of swimming and swimming pools and of nude bathing and naturism and of cricket and of chess and of football, soccer in English terms, in these diaries. When it comes to the World Wars, because of course the diaries stretch over the World Wars, he is describing the aerial bombardments of London in both wars and the preventive measures that they had to take. The family would be roused repeatedly at night and would have to go down to the shelters. All of that is really valuable social history, and I'm trying to weave all of that into my story of this pioneering advocate for sexual freedom and for the better treatment of prisoners.
That is an impressive task to undertake, certainly. I wonder if we could switch tacks for a minute and talk a little bit about how the archive itself came to be preserved and came to end up scattered across the various locations where it's currently housed. And I wonder if when Ives was collecting all this material, did he have an intention for it to be preserved together? Did he bequeath it to someone? Was this something that was sort of collected and safeguarded by a sort of friend or family member? What is the kind of origin story for how this archive came to us in the public and made its way to the various institutions where it now resides?
Ives certainly wanted it to be preserved. He describes various reasons for writing the diary in particular at various points. One is simply as an aid memoir so that he can go back and look over the various notes he's been taking so that he can write lectures from it, give talks, that type of thing. Another is a kind of a form of therapy so he can work out his own thinking. And he was quite psychologically volatile, shall we say, rather depressive, morose at times. So he's working things out through his diary. But he also says repeatedly that his diary is, quote, a mine for the making of history. And he addresses his future biographer. He says, I hope one day that somebody will be reading this and making sense of it. And one of the points he apologizes to his future biography is that, you know, my future biographer will have no way of figuring out what I just said. And there are lots of very obscure passages, and some passages in code, and I'm still trying to work through those codes. But he did want somebody to take the diary seriously one day. So what happened was that he bequeathed the diaries to his so-called literary executor when he died in 1950. The executor at some point, probably in the 50s, sold the diaries to a private collector who lived in the New Forest in the south of England. Now, that is where Geoffrey Weeks, the pioneering historian of homosexuality that I talked about, came across them. He was aware of the diaries and he paid a visit to this collector so that he could have a look at, dip into the diaries to make use of them for his pioneering book. This collector at that point asked Weeks whether a library might be interested in purchasing them because he didn't want them anymore for whatever reason. Maybe he'd read all the way through them. Attempts were made to interest the British Library and other places in Britain. But this was the 1970s, and LGBTQ history hadn't started really at all. And no library in Britain was interested. So Weeks suggested to this collector, well, there is this place in the US. It's called the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas in Austin. It's got lots of money, and it buys everything to do with writers' writings in the 19th, particularly the late 19th, early 20th centuries, the modernist period, on both sides of the Atlantic. They may well be interested. So contact was made with the Harry Ransom Center. The Harry Ransom Center said, yes, please, we'll take them, and paid the princely sum of $5,000 to purchase all of the diaries and all of the associated correspondence of the British Society for the Study of Sex Psychology. So they all ended up in the Harry Ransom Center. The scrapbooks, how and why they ended up in the hands of a London bookseller, bibliographer in the 70s, I don't know, but they did. And this bookseller, bibliographer, wrote a brief description with examples from the scrapbooks, and then I think donated or maybe sold them to the Beinecke Library rather later, sometime in the 90s. So that's how the scrapbooks became separated from the rest of the archive.
That is quite a journey. And it sounds like Ives was very self-aware and intentional about writing for a public audience. And in fact, writing, it sounds like, for you, Brian, as his biographer all these years later and as someone investigating his work thoroughly.
I'm really quite fortunate because Ives detested the United States and all things American. So he would have found it really ironic that everything ended up in the United States. But if all of this archive had been in London throughout the period from the late 70s when LGBTQ history was getting underway, there would have been lots of scholars who would have pored over them by now. The fact that they were thousands of miles away in Texas, really quite expensive for British scholars to visit, has delayed the investigation of them and given me an opportunity that I might not otherwise have had coming down from Canada to Texas.
I'd like to end today, Brian, by asking you just to reflect in all of the research you've done across all of these sources. Is there one record or piece of writing or reflection that has stayed with you, that has remained memorable, that perhaps was unexpected? It sounds like Ives covered a vast array of topics and had quite a personality as he was doing so. But I wonder if you can pick out one particular anecdote that helps you to understand more about Ives as a person.
I think the thing that surprised me the most when I first came across it was his attitude towards capital punishment. Because Ives, he started off a conservative, as you would expect, coming from the English landowning classes. But because of his sexuality and his interest in prison reform, he quickly, in his early 20s, moved in the direction of a form of socialism or anarchism. And also a rejection of Christianity. So he ended up some kind of agnostic deist, as he described it. His interest in totally transforming the way that the prison system works and the understanding of prisons, the notion that crime is something coming out of the environment, that we are all potentially criminals, there are no born criminals or anything like that, is perfectly consistent with that socialist anarchist line. But at the same time, he adopted the fashionable contemporary notion of a kind of, not a born criminality, but a kind of born degeneracy. So he believed that there were some individuals who were simply unreformable. And because he had no fear of death himself, he often talked about suicide, that this is the way he would probably go in the end, and he would see death as a friend, as a liberation. He talked in these terms. He thought that could apply to others as well. So he came to the belief that anyone who could not be reformed in the prison system or in society, if they couldn't be mended, they should be ended. So he advocated they should be, as he put it, painlessly exterminated. And the first time I read that, it was really quite a jolt. And it remains quite a jolt reading that. It's not uncommon for progressives of that period to advocate the same. George Bernard Shaw is the most famous example of doing the same. But it's the most jarring thing for us now, looking back. And if I can say one other thing that is problematic and jarring as well, and that is the fact that the Greek tradition that most of these reformers were relying upon was the pederastic tradition, age-stratified relationships. Although Ives's relationships were all with adults, this notion of pederasty, not pedophilia, is a crucial distinction, but in our Me Too moment of our time, it has become, in some ways, quite difficult to talk about, and that was not the case, I would say, even 15, 20 years ago. So that is another aspect that I am treating very seriously and delicately.
This is a good indication of how perspectives change over time, and we need to keep that in mind when we are doing any kind of focused historical work. Brian, I want to thank you for joining us today, and I want to thank everyone who has joined us for this discussion as well. Please tune into the next episode of Discovery and Inspiration from the National Humanities Center.